Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today we are talking about a topic that seems familiar to all of us, but whose roots go much deeper than most people think.
Right, Christmas in the Middle Ages, from pagan roots to Christian tradition.
And I have to be honest, when I researched this topic, I was surprised how much of it actually had nothing to do with Christianity.
Right, the Christmas season has always been a very special phase in the European yearly cycle. Imagine, the harvest is over, the provisions are stored, and then the stillness settles over the land.
No more fieldwork, nature comes to rest.
Right, and for people it was a time between hope and fear. Would the provisions last? How long would the darkness continue?
The darkness? That's not really something we think about today, is it?
Not at all. We flip a switch and it's bright. But for people without electricity, imagine, from October the days get shorter and shorter. In December you might only have 7-8 hours of daylight. The rest is darkness.
And that affects your psyche, right? I mean, we know that today as seasonal depression.
Absolutely, and back then?
There was no light therapy for that.
Exactly. People had to cope differently. And that's why the winter solstice was so important. On December 21st, in the Northern Hemisphere, is the shortest day of the year.
And the longest night.
Exactly that one. And from then on, the days finally get longer again. For people in ancient times, that was, not just an astronomical event.
But?
It was Yule, a great pagan festival where, symbolically, the darkness was supposed to give way to light. The return of the sun was celebrated.
So, a symbolic victory of light over darkness?
Exactly. The darkness recedes, the light returns.
All night long?
All night long. Especially in Scandinavia and Iceland, great fires were lit, often on hills or central squares, that often burn through much of the night.
That must have been an incredible sight. Fires everywhere across the landscape.
And it had deep symbolic meaning. With these fires, people invoked the sunrise. The light was supposed to return. The time of darkness was supposed to end.
That's almost like a collective act of will against the darkness.
Perfectly put. And the background is this natural cycle. After death, meaning autumn, when nature gradually comes to a standstill, comes rebirth.
It gets bright, a new cycle begins, things grow again, and people find hope.
That's true. And when we look at it today, with all our electric lights and heated homes, we can hardly imagine how existential this darkness was.
I once read that even today, many people struggle with low moods in winter. And we have light therapy lamps.
Right. In the Middle Ages, there was nothing like that. People had to help themselves differently. Through community, through festivals, through exactly these light rituals.
And Yule wasn't just Germanic, was it?
No, the winter solstice was celebrated in many cultures. In the original Julian calendar, that's the old Roman calendar, the winter solstice actually fell on December 25th. But due to calendar inaccuracies, it had already shifted to December 21st by the 4th century. But December 25th remained symbolically important.
Wait, that's our Christmas date.
Right. The Romans had a major festival in mid-December, the Saturnalia, with gifts, celebrations, and even role reversal. Everything was turned upside down. And on December 25th itself, starting from 274 AD, Sol Invictus was celebrated, the unconquered sun god.
So there were already gifts at the winter solstice back then.
Yes, and in Celtic areas, other traditions developed. people dressed in clothes of the opposite gender for dancing and wore animal masks.
That sounds wild.
The Midwinter Festival knew many such customs. And Christianity later essentially incorporated many of them into what we know today as Christmas.
So a kind of cultural takeover.
You could call it that. The Christian church understood that these festivals were deeply rooted in culture, so they Christianized them instead of fighting them.
Clever, in a way.
Very clever, even. But that also means that many of our current Christmas traditions, the tree, the candles, the gifts, have precursors or parallels in the old winter customs, even though they've been heavily Christianized.
That's fascinating. We're celebrating something thousands of years old today, without knowing it.
Absolutely. And this idea that light follows the darkest night, that rebirth comes after death, that's a universal human need.
For hope in the darkness.
Perfectly summarized. And the Romans especially had their very own, very exuberant way of expressing this hope.
Exuberant how?
Just think of the Saturnalia we briefly touched on. That was a festival that really turned all rules upside down and lasted a whole week.
And what did it look like?
It was... exuberant is an understatement. The festival originally lasted one day, but was later extended to up to 7 days. There were public feasts at state expense, where even the poor and homeless were fed.
At state expense? That's almost social welfare.
And then the celebrating continued in homes, with lavish meals, plenty of wine, visits to friends and relatives. The streets were full of people.
And the gifts?
Were already part of it. People exchanged small figurines called sigillaria, made of wax or clay, which were sold at special markets.
So there were Christmas markets back then?
Something like that. People also exchanged wax candles and small branches, often hung with sweets.
That sounds almost like our modern gift-giving traditions.
And the craziest thing, social rules were completely turned upside down. Masters served their slaves at the feast, and slaves were allowed to speak freely, even voice criticism.
Really? That must have been chaotic.
It was intentionally chaotic. They elected a lord of misrule who led the company to increasingly wild activities. Mock poems were recited. Gambling, otherwise forbidden, was allowed.
So a complete reversal of order.
Correct. And the Romans took off their toga, the formal official garb, and wore comfortable tunics instead. Even the courts and schools were closed.
That sounds like a collective moment to breathe.
It was probably exactly that. After a hard year in the fields, people needed this time of reverie.
And what about those other European regions? You mentioned those too.
Ah, it gets even more interesting. Although this was previously often attributed to the Celts, these customs are actually documented in England, Germany, and Scandinavia from the Middle Ages onwards, at Christmas, New Year, and Shrovetide.
Namely?
It was about the cross-dressing you mentioned, the exchange of clothing.
Wait, what?
Yes, men in women's clothing, women in men's clothing. And they wore animal masks.
Animal masks?
Often carved from wood or leather, sometimes real animal hides. It had deep symbolic meaning.
But why?
The reversal? It was about the temporary suspension of all order. At the winter solstice, the world essentially stood still. The shortest day, the longest night. The old rules no longer applied.
So a kind of ritual chaos.
Right. The animal masks were meant to drive away evil spirits and ensure fertility. The cross-dressing was part of this ritual renewal. Everything was reshuffled so the new year could begin well.
That's fascinating. And completely different from the Roman festival.
Two different cultures, but both had the same core. The winter solstice was the moment when the old order ends and a new one begins.
And Christianity then?
Essentially adopted all these customs. The midwinter festival, whether Roman or Celtic, had so many traditions deeply anchored in the culture.
But how long did that take, the Christian takeover?
It was a long process. The birth of Jesus as a holiday is only really documented from the mid-4th century, around 354 AD.
Oh, so about 350 years after Jesus.
Right. The early Christians celebrated Easter, the resurrection, as the most important festival. The birth wasn't originally so central.
And why the change then?
For purely pragmatic reasons. The church saw how important these midwinter festivals were for people's identity. A direct ban would have only created resistance, so they chose a different path.
They gave them a new meaning.
Exactly. Instead of Saturn, you now celebrate Jesus. Instead of the rebirth of the sun, you celebrate the birth of Christ. But the structure, the gifts, the lights, the celebrating, stayed the same.
A really pragmatic strategy.
Very clever, even. The missionary Boniface, then Bishop of Mainz, wrote to Pope Zacharias around 742, complaining that the people in Germania were still practicing their old customs in pagan style.
So it didn't work right away?
Not at all. People held on to their traditions. It took centuries for Christian Christmas to really take hold.
And yet, the old roots are still visible today.
That's right. When we decorate a tree or light candles today, we're actually still celebrating, in a way, these ancient winter festivals.
That makes the whole thing somehow more meaningful, doesn't it?
I think so too. It shows how deeply these traditions are rooted in us, across cultures and religions. But why do we actually celebrate on December 25th exactly?
Because Jesus was born on that day, right?
The interesting thing is, the date itself probably has multiple roots. The theological calculation from March 25th and the proximity to pagan winter festivals. The birth of Christ was then moved to the winter solstice in the 4th century.
But he really was born on that day, wasn't he?
Some theologians speculate that due to the mention of shepherds in the fields, Jesus might have been born in autumn. But that's not certain.
Wait, in autumn?
Yes, the Bible mentions a census. Some argue that such counts took place after the harvest, but that's historically disputed.
So in autumn?
Exactly. After the harvest, people had time and the authorities could carry out the tax collection.
That makes sense. But how do you get to December 25th then?
From a theological perspective?
Was there a decision? A church council or something?
Not really a single council. The first written mention of December 25th comes from the year 354 AD, from a Roman calendar work.
So relatively late?
More than 300 years after Jesus' death. It was a gradual process. The earliest certain mention, the chronograph of 354 that I just mentioned, probably comes from the time of Pope Liberius. But there was no major official determination by a council or anything. It simply gradually became established, especially in Rome and then throughout the empire.
So it was a strategic decision?
Very strategic even. The early Christians had several reasons. One was theological symbolic. It was assumed that the word was created on March 25th.
And 9 months later?
Right, December 25th. It was a kind of allegorical calculation.
But the other reason?
The overlay of pagan festivals. On December 25th, the festival of Sol Invictus was celebrated in the Roman Empire, the unconquered sun god.
Oh, the church simply took over the existing holiday?
Reinterpreted, I'd say. Instead of the sun god, you now celebrate Christ as the light of the world. People loved this festival, so they Christianized it, as I said, instead of fighting it.
That's clever, but also a bit cunning, isn't it?
Pragmatic. The church understood how to win new believers.
And what about the word Weihnachten itself? Where does that come from?
That's fascinating too. Some authors assume it goes back to the 12 holy nights of Yule, known today as the Rauhnächte or Rough Nights.
The Rough Nights? I know those.
Right. They are counted from the birth of Jesus to the arrival of the three wise men. So, around the turn of the year.
But originally they weren't Christian, were they?
Not at all. Originally, the Rough Nights testified to the wild behavior of the powers of the Dark Winter. It was said that these powers retreated in early January.
And what did people do during this time?
They followed strict rules, stayed indoors as much as possible, fumigated their homes and stables with incense and other herbs to drive away evil spirits.
So real protective measures?
Absolutely. White laundry wasn't allowed to hang outside. People believed the wild hunt would steal it and later use it as a burial shroud.
That's creepy.
The Rough Nights were also known as oracles. According to old folk wisdom, each of the 12 nights revealed the weather for a month in the coming year.
So the first night stands for January, the second for February.
And so on. That was existentially important for farmers. Their lives literally depended on the weather and the harvest.
And the church adopted that too?
It was only medieval Christmas that assigned a Christian meaning to the Rough Nights. They connected them with the birth of Jesus and the three wise men. But the old magic remained alive in folk belief.
Fascinating. And when does the word Weihnachten first appear?
These are, of course, all speculations with the Rough Nights. For the term Weihnachten, we only find concrete evidence in the 12th century. So in the High Middle Ages.
And what was it called then?
In adjectival form as Wiehenaht, Holy Night. In a sermon collection, the Speculum Ecclesiae, it says in Middle High German, Dio Gnade, Dio anergingete, sie an dire naht. Von Dio heizet, sie Dio wiehe naht.
What does that mean translated?
Roughly, grace began on this night. Therefore, it is called the Holy Night.
So, Weihnachten literally means the Holy Night?
That's quite possible. Whether it really comes from the 12 Holy Nights of Yule can't be conclusively determined. But the connection seems likely.
It's crazy how many layers this festival has. Pagan roots, Roman festivals, Christian reinterpretation.
And all of that merges into what we know today. The date, the name, the meaning, everything has grown over centuries and been reinterpreted again and again.
And in the end, most people don't even know where it all comes from anymore.
That's perhaps what's special about it. These traditions have so many roots that almost every culture can find something in them. This Christianization was, of course, not a process that happened overnight. It took centuries.
People held on to their old traditions?
Absolutely. The missionary Boniface, at the time a papal legate, complained in letters in the 8th century about pagan customs in Germania that were still being practiced over 400 years after the official introduction of the festival.
And they were still celebrating in pagan ways?
Right. He complained about the pagan customs, sacrificial feasts, tree worship, eating horse meat, all the things people continued to practice.
He complained?
Bitterly even. That shows how deeply these customs were rooted. The church couldn't simply ban them.
So they adopted them?
Reinterpreted, you could say. Many customs of the Midwinter Festival were integrated into Christian Christmas. The tree, the candles.
The candles. We already had those at the winter solstice.
Correct. The light symbolism was central. And it continued in the Christian context. Then the mistletoe. That comes from the old customs.
The Advent wreath is much later, but picks up on the light symbolism.
But why these particular symbols? What makes a tree so special?
The evergreen. In a time when everything around you is dying, the leaves fall, the fields are bare, suddenly there are these trees that defiantly stay green.
A symbol of hope?
And of life. The ancient peoples saw in them the embodiment of eternal life. Fir, spruce, pine, holly, these were the trees that didn't give up, even in the harshest winter.
And the church simply adopted that?
With a new interpretation. The green tree was now supposed to represent the hope of Christian life. You decorate your house with fir branches and holly garlands.
So the coming harvest will be good?
Right. So the coming summer will be fruitful. People brought the greenery into the house, almost like an invocation.
But in the Middle Ages, they didn't have a whole tree in the house yet, did they?
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
Right. In ancient times, people brought branches into the house. In the late Middle Ages, there were paradise plays and churches, decorated with apples. But the real Christmas tree as we know it, decorated in the house, only emerged from the 16th century onwards, mainly in Alsace. First records from Strasbourg. 1539 in the cathedral, 1605 in private homes.
And the branches also had a practical purpose?
To drive away the malicious spirits of the dark season. Holly, with its spiky leaves, was considered especially effective. Like a kind of spiritual protective fence.
So, protection and hope at the same time.
Perfectly summarized. And then the candles on the tree. They're a symbol of sunlight and life.
Wait, candles on the tree? That sounds dangerous.
Unthinkable today, but there's evidence for it from 1611. Real candles on real branches. Initially only among the wealthy. The light was supposed to literally drive away the darkness.
And the Advent wreath?
That's interesting, because its round circle
is a sun symbol?
That's how it's often interpreted. The round circle can be seen as a symbol of the sun. But, and this is fascinating, the Advent wreath as we know it was actually only invented in 1839.
What? That's almost modern.
A Protestant theologian in Hamburg, Johann Heinrich Wichern, developed it. He took a large wagon wheel, put 23 candles on it, 4 large ones for the Advent Sundays, 19 small ones for the weekdays.
So the sun symbolism was added later?
The shape was originally simply practical. It was a wagon wheel. But the interpretation as a sun symbol was added later. And it was probably inspired by older customs.
How so?
In folk belief, people had long decorated round wreaths at the winter solstice, with greenery, with the colors of light, red and gold.
Red and gold? Like today still?
Right. These colors were meant to honor the sun and invoke a quick end to the hard winter.
Because supplies were running low?
The hard winter often meant bitter hardship. The harvests were brought in, but would they last until spring? Could people survive until the next sowing?
That's why all these symbols of hope.
It was existential. Today we just go shopping at the supermarket. But back then, if the supplies ran out in February, that could mean death.
And the Advent wreath was supposed to help against that?
As a symbol, yes. It was supposed to maintain hope that the sun returns, that winter ends, that life goes on.
Although today most people don't know where it all comes from anymore.
The Advent wreath is in nearly every home, Red and gold are still the traditional Christmas colors. But the original meaning?
Is forgotten. We simply decorate without knowing that we are reenacting ancient survival rituals.
Although the rituals aren't that ancient with the Advent wreath, but the symbolism, the greenery, the light, the round shape, draws on much older traditions.
A mix of old and new.
And that's essentially what Christmas is. Layer upon layer of traditions that have overlapped. Pagan customs, Roman festivals, Christian reinterpretations, modern inventions.
And each one contributed something.
Every era, every culture has added its own symbols. But the core remained the same. Light in the darkness, hope in winter, life in death.
That's actually pretty universal, isn't it?
It's a basic human need. Whether you live in ancient Rome or medieval Germany, winter is hard and you need something to hold on to.
And tradition gives us that.
But how did people actually celebrate Christmas in the Middle Ages specifically?
That's the exciting part, after all the theory and symbolism.
The first precursors of the Christmas tree actually come from the Middle Ages. And baking at Christmas time also has its origins here.
Baking? Like cookies?
Among other things. Since 1329, first documented mention in Naumburg, there's been Stollen. Today its shape is often interpreted as the swaddled Christ child.
The swaddled baby Jesus?
Exactly. Today we know it as Stollen. Its name actually comes from the shape, which resembles a wooden beam. And dusted with powdered sugar, it's a classic in many variations.
Oh, I didn't know that. So Stollen is basically an edible nativity scene?
You could see it that way. But of course, at Christmas in the Middle Ages, there was mainly one thing. Lots of feasting.
At pretty much every festival, right?
But Christmas was especially lavish. England's King John ordered enormous quantities for his Christmas feast in 1213 at Windsor Castle.
How enormous?
Dozens of wine barrels, hundreds of pig heads, and no fewer than...
10,000 eels?
10,000 eels! Can you imagine?
That's absurd. How long did the preparation take?
Interestingly, the royal officials probably only had about a week's lead time for such a feast. That was a logistical masterpiece.
A week? For 10,000 eels?
And all the other things. In the kitchen alone, dozens of cooks and well over 100 helpers worked at such feasts.
That's like a small army.
And the feast didn't last just one day. The Christmas octave, the 8 days after Christmas, was celebrated throughout.
So a whole week of festivities.
Exactly. With banquets, church services, gifts.
But surely only for the court, right?
Chroniclers like Matthew Paris report on the splendor of such feasts. Although access was of course strictly limited to nobility, courtiers and officials. Common people at best received alms or leftovers. But for the elite, the king demonstrated his generosity.
But that was of course the nobility. What about...
the peasants? They celebrated too. From various manor records, we know that lords sometimes provided food for the common people for the feast.
Sometimes?
It wasn't everywhere, but such traditions existed. A shepherd from Somerset, for example, received a loaf of bread and a meat dish on Christmas Eve.
But that's a stark contrast.
Between 10,000 eels and a loaf of bread? Absolutely. Class society was clearly visible even at Christmas.
But at least the peasant class celebrated too.
Yes, and it was important. For many, it was the only festival of the year when they had plenty to eat.
Although plenty is relative.
A loaf of bread and a meat dish was probably quite a little feast for a shepherd back then. We shouldn't measure by today's standards.
True. And what about gifts? Did they already exist?
The custom of giving gifts is, of course, much older. But in Christian Europe, gift-giving customs developed around St. Nicholas Day. The figure of the Christ child as gift-bringer, someone completely different, brought that to life.
Who?
Martin Luther, the Protestant reformer.
Luther? That surprises me.
Luther wanted to abolish the veneration of saints. Until then, St. Nicholas brought the gifts on December 6th.
But Nicholas is a saint?
And that was exactly Luther's problem. He rejected the veneration of saints as unbiblical. So from the 1530s onwards, he promoted the Holy Christ, the Christ child.
As a Protestant alternative?
Right. And he shifted gift-giving from St. Nicholas Day to Christmas. This made the festival Christ-centered. It was about the birth of Christ, not a saint.
That's clever. And it caught on?
Slowly, but yes. First in Protestant areas, later even in Catholic ones. The Christ child became the angelic figure we know today.
Although today it's often Santa Claus who comes.
He's a much later invention, and actually a return to Nicholas, just secularized.
Crazy how it all developed.
When you look at the whole thing, Christmas in the Middle Ages wasn't so different in its fundamentals from our Christmas today.
Really not?
The symbolism, the customs, the celebrating, the gifts, we still have much of that. But as always, it depends.
Which time, which class, which region you're looking at.
That's right. Both had their tradition.
Both had their tradition.
And these traditions, whether pagan, Roman, Christian or Reformation, have developed over centuries into what we know today as Christmas.
It's fascinating how many layers are in there.
Every era contributed something. And somehow that's nice, that this festival has so many roots and has connected so many people over the centuries.
When you look at all of it, it's almost unbelievable how many layers are in our Christmas celebration.
We started with pagan roots, Yule, the winter solstice, the fires in the longest night.
Through the Romans with their Saturnalia, the Celts with their animal masks.
To the Christian takeover and reinterpretation of all these customs.
And the fascinating thing is the continuity. The lights, the trees, the celebrating itself. All of that was preserved, even when religion changed.
That shows how deeply these symbols are rooted in human experience. As we mentioned at the beginning, light in the darkness, hope in winter, these are universal needs.
And it makes no difference whether you believe in Germanic gods, in Sol Invictus, or in Jesus Christ. The longing for light and life remains the same.
What also impressed me, how different the celebrations were depending on class and region. King John with his 10,000 eels.
And the shepherd with his loaf of bread.
Absolutely. But both celebrated. That's the point. Whether nobility or peasant, whether rich or poor, everyone had their traditions, their way of observing this festival.
And when you sit under the Christmas tree today with the candles or LED lights and gifts,
you carry all this history with you. The pagan branches against evil spirits, the Roman gift exchange, Luther's Christ child.
It's like a cultural palimpsest?
Perfect image. Layer upon layer. But all still visible if you look closely.
Although most people don't know that anymore.
Maybe that's not a bad thing. Traditions work even without knowing their origins.
But it's nice to know, isn't it?
Absolutely. It gives things more depth. When you know that the Advent wreath, at least in its modern form, comes from Hamburg in the 19th century, but the idea of the sun symbol is much older,
it becomes more interesting.
That's an important point. Ultimately, there isn't the one medieval Christmas, but countless facets.
The experience of a king was completely different from that of a peasant.
And yet, they all shared in this long history in their own way.
That's the complexity of history that we often forget.
But at its core, the lights, the coming together, the celebrating despite the darkness, everyone agrees on that.
And that continues through to today.
That's true. Our modern Christmas isn't as different as you might think.
In the end, it's a story about
continuity and change at the same time. Traditions change, get reinterpreted, gain new meanings. But the core remains.
And I think that only makes them more valuable.
If you're interested in historical topics like this, and I hope you are after this episode, then check out the Battle Merchant blog. There you'll find many more exciting stories about medieval life, customs, equipment, and historical backgrounds.
For everyone who wants to dive deeper into history.
Perfect. And with that, we say goodbye for today. Thanks for listening.
We hope you had as much fun as we did. Until next time.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your swords sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.